This is In Focus, the weekly public affairs program from KTBB and the Team Sports Radio, featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place.
Good morning, everybody. Good to have you with us on In Focus. We're going to spend some time talking about hunger in our states. And joining us is Celia Cole. She's CEO of Feeding Texas. Celia, good morning. Good to have you here.
Good morning, Roger. Great to be here.
And it's great to have you. Let's first of all explain what Feeding Texas is all about.
Sure. So Feeding Texas is the state association of food banks. So together with our 20 food banks, we make up the largest anti-hunger organization in Texas. And we reach every county with hunger relief and other services.
And that's a lot of counties. What, 250? What do we have? Something like
254
that?
254 is what we're at.
254. Well, okay. One of the things that intrigued me is, let's start with the one big issue that I know you guys are doing some advocacy on. And that is, we are one of the states, one of apparently, what, only 13 states that chose not to participate in the summer food program for kids. Tell us what that's about.
Yeah, so the summer food program, summer EBT as it's known, is a program that was created a couple of years ago to basically tackle a really important issue, which is that kids, when school is out in the summer, kids without school meals, so they get to eat free during the school year. And the summer comes along, and suddenly they go without those meals. And so we typically see hunger spike in the summer months. We see more families with children in our lines needing emergency food. So this program was created a couple of years ago by Congress to solve that problem and make sure that kids stay nourished and ready to learn in the summer.
Well, and for example, we're in the middle of the holidays right now. The kids, through no fault of their own, there are a lot of young people, a lot of children, who depend on school lunches and school breakfasts. They're not going to get them right during the holidays.
Right. Yeah. So about 1 in 6 Texas households faces hunger, and 1 in 5 kids in Texas live in a food insecure household. So that is a lot of kids.
Well, yeah, and so take the holiday lapse for them in terms of a good meal, and stress that out over 3 months. That's a long time.
That's right. And it's for many kids, summer is a time of fun and play, and but for kids who rely on school meals, hunger doesn't take a vacation. So it's critically important to make sure we get extra resources to those families during the summer months so kids don't go hungry.
I think I can probably guess, but what are you told are the reasons for Texas refusing to participate?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much that they refused, but I think when the program was ready to get, up and running, which was last summer, the state, the Health and Human Services Commission, was facing serious backlogs in getting people enrolled in SNAP, which is the biggest anti-hunger program in the country. That, due to the Medicaid unwinding, the end of the pandemic, they were short-staffed, and people were waiting months to get enrolled in SNAP. So they were really directing all of their time and resources to trying to get through that backlog and get caught up. And, so our understanding was, we just don't have the time. We don't have time to resources to get it going for 2024. Mm-hmm. Here we are now, heading into 2025, and we're, kind of, it feels like sort of in limbo. So the state has a plan to implement. Now they need the funds approved by the legislature to help them administer the program. So the benefits, which is, it's equal to about $120 a summer, mm-hmm. per kid, that basically comes in the form of like a grocery card, like a debit card. It's built off the SNAP infrastructure. So the benefits are 100% federally funded, but states pick up half the cost of administering the program. It's those funds that the state is waiting to hear about. And so we need the legislature to give them a green light that those funds will be available no later than March 1st for them to have time to implement in 2025. So that's what we're waiting on hearing, is approval from the legislature.
So we really don't know for sure yet. But this money is largely federal. I mean, this is free money.
It is. 100% federal, and it's about $450 million food dollars we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So based on sort of some estimates that our partners in D.C. have done, looking at enrollment and mm-hmm. school meals during the year in Texas, about, you know, between 3.5 and 4 million kids are likely eligible to participate, and that translates to about $450 million in food aid. So not something we want to go without this summer. And so we're, in a little bit of limbo here, waiting to see if the legislature help the state provide the resources to them to get the program going in time.
Well, other than administering it, and you already have the list of families getting SNAP benefits, the money, it's free money. It's money coming to the state. I can't imagine why we would pass on that.
It's like we have a moral imperative, right, to feed kids. But it's also like in our best interest to look out for their well-being, to keep them nourished and healthy and ready to learn, because they're our future, right? So there's that. And then I think it's also important to note that this program is also a valuable economic driver, just like the SNAP program is. So we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of food dollars that provide a significant boost to food retailers, to local economies across the state. And this is especially true for small businesses, small food retailers operating in rural communities. So it's not just about, you know, it's not just a moral imperative or the right thing to do or the right thing for Texas's future, but it really provides a really significant boost to rural economies. So that's just another reason why we should put up the money and get the program up and running.
Well, and that's the part of this that I think a lot of people forget is, yes, it is a benefit. Yes, it's government money, but it's going to get spent. It's going to be spent locally.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It just goes right back into our economy. It lifts families out of poverty. It keeps kids nourished and ready to learn during the summer. We can't afford to let kids fall behind every summer, you know, and mm-hmm. when kids aren't nourished, it leads to all sorts of problems. So you see this during the school year, and the reason why the school breakfast program, school lunch program is so important is that when kids come to school hungry, they can't learn. You hear this from nurses all the time, you know, kids showing up at 10 a.m. with headaches in their office. Because they're hungry, and it also, you know, leads to health issues and really long-term kind of cognitive development problems when kids are hungry in sort of the early years. So we've got all this research that tells us, you know, it's important to keep kids nourished. It's much more sort of cost-effective to keep them fed and then pay for the problems that come up later on. Leads to higher health costs. It leads to higher education costs when it costs more to educate and care for kids that are hungry. So this is, you know, not a lot of money to put up for a big bang for the buck in the long run.
It's pretty hard to pay attention to algebra when your stomach is growling, right? Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we all know this. Like, we've all, you know, skipped a meal. You know, been caught at work and didn't have time to get lunch. And it's not just sort of physically painful. But, yeah, it really affects your ability to concentrate. And it can be really, I think, stressful for kids. We know that even, like, you know, short bouts of food insecurity in childhood can have really lasting consequences. So this is a way to plug that gap, you know, in the summer when kids are most likely to go hungry.
How many kids are we talking about? I think we probably glossed over that at the very beginning, but
yeah.
What chunk of the population are we looking at?
So the estimate is about 3.75 million kids would likely be eligible, and that's based on looking at eligibility for school meals in the 2022-2023 school year. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the population it's intended to support. If any kid that is eligible during the school year for free or reduced price meals, the income limits are different. If you're below a certain percentage of the poverty level, then you get free meals. And if your income is a little bit higher, but still you're low income, you get a reduced price. So that's the population. So we're talking about a lot of kids. I mean, if you look at the, you know, Texas public school enrollment, about 2/3 of kids are actually fall into that category of being low income.
2/3?
Qualifying. So it's a lot. We're talking about a lot of kids. And like I said, it's not just a moral imperative, but, you know, we have, I think, a real duty to keep kids nourished and look out for their development. And in the long term, they're our most important asset, you know. So yeah. Their nourishment, their development should really be a top priority for the legislature.
And again, that was something that you said quickly, but two-thirds... Are qualified for this?
They do. They qualify. Yeah, it's a lot of kids. We have a state with high poverty levels, and poverty is really linked to food insecurity. So anywhere you have a lot of families that are low income or living in poverty, you're going to have food insecurity as well. It's the biggest driver. It's just a lack of resources.
It's a phrase we hear a lot. How technically do we define food insecurity?
Yeah, it's actually, it's a term that was developed in the early 90s. It's basically a questionnaire that goes out with all sorts of, surveys, like the current population survey that goes out every year. And it's a series of questions that asks people about whether over the past, 12 months, they've struggled to afford food. And based on how they answer those questions, they're either classified as food secure or they're classified as food insecure. So basically, it's the lack of resources, financial resources, to consistently afford food, basically.
And we are, according to what I'm reading on your website, we are number two in the nation for food insecurity.
About one in six Texas households struggle with food insecurity. Like I said earlier, among kids, the rate of food insecurity is even higher. Almost one in five kids are in families that are food insecure. So it's a big problem. I think the good news, though, is that when Congress cuts funding to programs like EBT or SNAP, these are proven programs. They're proven to prevent hunger. They're proven to lift families out of poverty. That's the good news, is that there are solutions out there. But like I said, the Texas legislature has to prioritize this program, and they've got to act quickly to do that. So the state has the time it takes to get the program going.
So the session will begin in January. Have you guys kept tabs on, is this proposal in the hopper? Is it on the schedule? Do we know if they're going to act quickly on this?
So we don't have any reassurances. It's a little bit amorphous right now. We haven't even really been able to see an estimate of what they think it's going to cost them, although we know they have one. I know they've talked with the leadership about it, and we are part of a group, 70-plus organizations across the state that make up the Texas Food Policy Roundtable. So this is organizations that are either anti-hunger organizations like the food banks in our network, like Feeding Texas. Many of them are health organizations. Mm-hmm. Some of them are focused on strengthening local food systems. So it's really a very wide-ranging group of organizations, all of whom have said, we want to make hunger a top priority, because it's like hunger sits at the intersection of so many other issues.
Yeah.
Health. Can you afford food? Can you afford housing? Can you put gas in your car? Any time you have a family that's food insecure, it's not something that just happens in a vacuum. You don't just wake up one day and realize you don't have any food in the fridge. Because it's related to a lack of financial resources. Typically, they're facing all sorts of other problems too, which is why we've been able to attract organizations focused on other issues to come together. And summer EBT is the priority, top priority for the Texas Food Policy Roundtable. So we are visiting with members of the legislature. We're talking to them about the importance of this program. Mm-hmm. My sense is that there is support for it on the House side. I'm not sure where the Senate is at. But then, of course, the House is sort of in a little bit of a uproar right now. There's sort of a leadership vacuum until we know who the next speaker is. So that'll also play a role, I think, in the outcome of the speaker's race will also play a role in sort of what priorities they focus on. Another kind of uncertainty at this point.
We kind of mirror the dysfunction nationally as well. We are talking about kids, but I know one area that you guys are very involved in is also with seniors and their issues of food insecurity. Apparently, again, it's one of those categories where you hate being in the top 10, but we have the eighth highest rate of senior food insecurity.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, food insecurity, it touches every county in the state. It affects people from all walks of life, but it does certainly affect some people more than others. So in addition to kids being at a higher rate of food insecurity, so are seniors. And so are people with disabilities. They have some of the highest rates of food insecurity. So when you look at participation in programs like SNAP, the vast majority of the people participating are seniors, kids, or people with disabilities. And with seniors, I think what you're seeing is like, you know, with inflation and high food prices and increases in everything, prices across the board, when you're a senior, you're on a fixed income, you don't have any ability to kind of grow your income, right, to pay for the rising costs of food and things like that. So right. I think that's why we're seeing a lot of seniors right now. So when we look at food bank lines, you know, that's who we see. We see families with kids, and we see seniors who just simply can't stretch their food budgets to deal with rising food prices. And then, of course, there's access issues for seniors, too. Like, can they get to the grocery store?
Right.
Do they know how to apply for SNAP? So our food banks help with all of that. We have trained people to help assist seniors and anyone really apply for SNAP benefits. We have done a lot with sort of home delivery to help seniors that are homebound. So the food banks are really working, I think, around the clock to deal with the increase in food insecurity, help people keep up with rising food costs. And that's why this program is so important, because food banks can't make up that loss of school meals. You know, we simply don't have the resources to keep every kid fed during the summer months. So this is another reason why the summer EBT program is so important. I mean, really fighting hunger is a private partnership. We do everything we can, but our resources are limited too. So this program is really, really important to also make sure the charitable food sector can keep up as well.
Well, and it is charitable, but we should probably point out to people that the largest number of people, at least families on SNAP benefits, families with kids, they are working. They just don't make much money.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're working, I think, just trying to pay for food, put gas in the car. Housing really is a big driver. So when you look at what low-income families are spending their money on, it's housing, it's food, you know, it's transportation. Those are the big things. So, obviously you can't use SNAP benefits to pay your rent. If we can get people who are qualified connected to SNAP and all of the other nutrition programs like school meals, like WIC, anything a person's eligible for, that frees up resources to pay for rent, you know, and to put gas in the car. You're right. It's people working in low-wage jobs, they're simply not keeping up. Their wages aren't keeping pace with increases in the cost of living. And so that's a big challenge. But you're right. We see a lot of working families. And working families qualify for SNAP. Like it doesn't matter if you're, you know, got a job, if it's not paying enough and your income falls below the limit, then you're qualified, you know. SNAP helps people stay employed and get back connected into the workforce, because you can't look for work when you're hungry. You know, we always say, like, hunger never helped anyone find a job.
Right.
So it's really important for working families in addition to seniors and kids. SNAP is the Farmer Food Stamp Program. It is the most important hunger fighting program we have in this country. It really does the heavy lift, you know, when it comes to fighting hunger. It reaches about 3.5 million Texans. And like I said, it reaches people from all walks of life. So that program got created back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was called food stamps because originally you actually got stamps, you know, paper stamps that you redeemed at the grocery store. And that got converted to this, what we call electronic benefits transfer, or EBT. And Texas was one of the leaders, I think, leading the way. We had people, everyone converted to that, the grocery card, the EBT card, decades ago. And the summer EBT program really is built off that infrastructure. So basically the electronic benefits transfer, which is why it's such a great benefit for, like I said, the small retailers and local communities, because people simply go in and they redeem those benefits. It's like a debit card, the buy food, And something else, a little bit of history here.
Yeah, obviously my memory banks failed me, yes.
Well, I don't remember the exact year, but Texas actually piloted a summer EBT program. I want to say it was at least 15 years ago, but we piloted it, and we did it in El Paso and also with Truth or Consequences New Mexico right across the border. We to sort of test interoperability, make sure that a card could be used in two different states. It was a really successful pilot, and it was the same idea. It was like, kids get out of school, they lose access to school meals, let's see if we can give them groceries through this grocery card. It was a really successful pilot, and we never implemented it. So here we are,
okay.
15, 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And it was the pandemic, actually, when schools shut down, and we were scrambling to figure out how do we replace those meals. So a program called Pandemic EBT, which is very similar to what we're seeing now with summer EBT, was put in place, and it was really effective. And again, that was why Congress a couple years ago said, well, we're going to create a permanent summer program, because the Pandemic EBT program was so successful.
Well, and digging back any farther, because I do know this part, the first idea of benefits occurred in Congress after World War II, when the military found that a lot of the draftees they were getting, particularly from the poor rural South, Appalachia, et cetera, were undernourished. They had to fatten them up to get through basic training. And they realized there was a problem there, and it served both the people themselves and the national interest and our military. Yes,
people were actually rejected from the draft because they were so malnourished, and that's when they created the National School Lunch Program. So the National School Lunch Program was a national security program. Mm-hmm. So fighting hunger has always been about more than, like I said, just a moral imperative. It's in our best interest. It's in the best interest of our country to have a well-nourished workforce. I mean, that's critical to our economic competitiveness. And like I said, it sounds like a cliche, but the children really are our future.
Yeah,
they're our future workforce. They're the ones that are going to take care of us when we're old. And again, hunger is a problem we can afford to solve, but it's not a problem we can afford to ignore.
Yeah, it's a snowball effect. I mean, they're going to become productive, tax-paying, you know, citizens, and they're going to manage my Social Security. So,
right,
there
exactly.
You go.
Definitely, people in our age bracket have a special interest.
Very special interest. Let's talk about some of the groups you work with, partnerships you have. What I found this kind of interesting for those. Let's see, are we in deer season? Has it started? I guess we are. Tell us about Hunters for the Hungry. I found that interesting.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite programs. It's a small program, but again, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, the legislature passed a bill essentially creating an option when you take a hunting or fishing license to donate to the Hunters for the Hungry program. So that created a funding stream that's been really critical to us expanding the program. So basically, we recruit processors, meat processors, to participate. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we promote the program with hunters. You, want to go out and hunt and you want to feed hungry people at the same time, you can drop off the carcass at a participating processor, and they grind it into 2-pound bags of ground venison. It's a super healthy, lean protein, and something we don't get donated a lot of. You know, we get a lot of food donated, and that's really important, but we don't always get lean protein donated. So this is a great way for people to give back to their communities. And then the funds that come through the donation when people take out a hunting or fishing license, and that we pay the processors to be participating, so it offsets their cost of getting the meat ready for consumption. But it's a great program. I love it.
Well, if you think about the food bank, because I know you also have a collaborative for fresh produce, a lot of what we think of in the food bank are shelf-stable products, canned, boxed, et cetera, a lot of rice, a lot of soup, that sort of thing. I guess it's kind of due to storage, I guess. kind of hard to get the fresh vegetables, the fresh meat, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, food banks have evolved a lot. I know people think of big, dusty warehouses filled with boxes and cans, but actually about half of the product we distribute right now is fresh produce.
Oh, good.
And that is because of that partnership with the Collaborative for Fresh Produce. They're sort of our sourcing agent down in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, and they essentially work very closely with donors and with food banks who have relationships with growers to get their surplus donated. So that's we're talking about, hundreds of millions of pounds of produce going out through our network. So we've really worked hard to expand our cold storage and expand our capacity to do more than dry goods and canned goods, and also support our network of local partners in building up their cold storage, because it's harder to get out perishable product. It's the logistics are more complicated, but
sure.
Food banks have done a wonderful job making sure that the food that we give out is the kind of food that people need to be healthy.
Well, and those in the listening audience in East Texas here, who are in the ag business, they know that not everything they grow is going to be accepted by, Walmart and Kroger and the big retailers, and otherwise it would go to waste.
That's right. It's that sort of ugly fruit, that you hear about. It's got the wrong size, or it's got a couple of extra. It's like the ziti food, I call it. It's got an extra bump on the potato, or the onion's not quite large enough. But it's all perfectly edible, perfectly nutritious food. We call it number two product, So that's basically where we operate most of that product. Or it's perfectly wonderful product, and there's simply like not the market for it, right? Like somebody grew too much, or so we get some top quality stuff as well, but mostly it's that those number twos that just can't make it to the market because they're not pretty enough.
Yeah, I know about that, but it'll eat just the same. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's even some companies now that are sort of, it's become almost trendy to buy the ugly fruit.
Well, and I've seen so many people in my business doing stories on how much good restaurant food is thrown out, store food is thrown out when it doesn't sell after a period, et cetera, that is still perfectly good, perfectly edible. We waste like half the food that's grown in this country.
Yeah, food waste is a big problem, and it really occurs everywhere. I mean, it occurs at the manufacturer, at the distributor, at the grower level, and at the household level, too. So this is, the Hunters for the Hungry program, obviously, it helps people go out and hunt more, and that's more sort of like, sports, but it also helps it's like a land stewardship program as well, because we have lots of, branches that have, real problems with deer, and this is an opportunity to sort of help them be good stewards of their land. So there's that. And then with the produce program, we always say it's a win-win-win for Texas because it feeds hungry people, it improves people's health, and it provides an outlet for product that otherwise end up in landfills and do bad things for our environment.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with the folks from the United Way, and you guys are part of the Texas Food Policy Roundtable, which, people aren't, you're all not working in a silo. I mean, you work together, United Way, you guys, No Kid Hungry, et cetera.
Yeah, we're sort of co-chairs, the United Way, Share Our Strengths, No Kid Hungry program, and then Feeding Texas. We co-chair that Food Policy Roundtable started, I think, I want to say back in like 2012, 2013. So it's been around for a while, but we've put a lot of resources into really growing the membership and really working not just, in the months leading up to the session or during the session, but we've started building a legislative agenda together with those partners in the Food Policy Roundtable so that we're more of a coordinated force during the session and we're all supporting and agreeing that on the top priorities. And so, like I said, for the session, our top priority is summer EBT.
What are you needing from the public? Donations, obviously.
We ask for three things. We ask for people to donate time. Our food banks really couldn't do what they do without the, you know, hundreds of volunteers and millions of volunteer hours that go to donate every year. So people can go to feedingtexas.org and find their food bank there. They can just enter the zip code and find a food bank where they can volunteer. They can also use that same function if they need food assistance to find a local pantry near them. So we ask for that time. And we ask for money, obviously. Food banks can really stretch those financial donations even further than food donations. So we encourage people to donate either to their food bank or to donate to Feeding Texas and support the work, our advocacy work. They can do that at feedingtexas.org. We have a donate button, and they can find their food bank and go donate there if they want. And then the third thing is voice. So time, money, voice. We need people to raise their voice with decision makers at the legislature in the upcoming session and let them know, look, I'm your constituent, and hunger is a priority, and summer EET is a solution, and we need you to fund it. We need you to support it.
Celia Cole, CEO of Feeding Texas, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Roger. Have a great day.
You too.
In Focus is a weekly public affairs program featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place. In Focus is produced by KTBB and the Team Sports Radio. And we thank you for listening. Join us again next week.